But I can remember I was working with one of the big airlines, and I was with a group of executives, and we were discussing, you know, they're making big changes, and they were interested in the application of some of these tools that I developed and what have you. And they were talking about the stress of the time. And I said, well, don't you need some sleep? And one of them piped up and said to me, well, you know what? I'll sleep when I'm dead. And I said, really? Well, then let me tell you something that I know, and that is that you're going to be dead a lot sooner than you expected.
Welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom, not cliches, banalities, or platitudes, to an international audience of rising leaders. My name is Duff Watkins, and I'm your host. Our guest today is neuroscientist Stan Rotsky. Stan has worked for 30 years, and, well, he's worked with professional sports teams, Olympic teams, men and women, boys and girls, and now he's here working with you and me. Stan, welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Cool. Thank you, Duff. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me tell you why here. True story. I'm talking to a podcast producer, Robert Hossery, years ago, and he was telling me about this phenomenon of adult coloring book. And I said, what? Is that a thing? He said, yeah, it's a thing. I said, it's got to be some American bullshit. And now I do some research and I found out, one, it's not American, it's Australian. Two, it's not bullshit, it's neuroscientists. And you're the guy that started all this with the coloration. And how do I know that? Because I'm listening to your audio book, The Mindfulness of Neuroscience, on my phone. And it's, in fact, there's a copy right behind you. It's not just a thing, it became quite a phenomenon. Is it true your books were featured on the Oprah Winfrey Show? I mean, there is no higher accolade than that, right?
No, look, I can absolutely tell you that's the truth. And, barring the fact that you can't have you in the word color, I thought Americans seeing the book would never occur. But a San Francisco publisher took it on with the others. And the story was, we got an email saying we were embargoed, which was a few months before its official launch by her, and we weren't allowed to talk about it until she broke the news of the book, and she and her best friend just loved the whole concept. And I was pleased that they did, because it isn't an infantile activity. It's actually a very powerful tool in the cupboard that can be used to help us perform better by relaxing first.
The neuroscience is what convinced me. I mean, I was, and that's why you're on the show, and that's why, because I need so many gaps in my knowledge. You know, we need people like you to fill them in. Let us start with, what was your first business lesson, Stan?
Look, I'd have to say that there've been a lot for a start, and I guess as a scientist, the thing that I learned was, and I'm not sure whether these words will communicate across every culture, but there's a lot of mumbo jumbo in science, and many of my colleagues would use a lot of words. Now, I'll give you an example of where I'm coming with my first lesson. What is a cognitive neuroscientist? That's me. Mm-hmm. I can sit here and sprawl to you about all of the other technical mumbo jumbo words that would define me. Or I could say to you, you know what, Duff? The way that you can get your head around me is that I'm a plumber and an electrician for the brain. I'm about the pipes, the taps, the fluids, and the electrical circuit board of the brain. Now, that's the lesson that I would give. I gave myself very early in the piece, and I give every student, doctor or whatever, who came through my labs or businesses, the same lesson. That is, turn off the mumbo jumbo, the jargon, and turn on the insight. People want to understand easily and quickly, you know, stuff that is usually out of their framework, out of the norm for them. And just more words that need definitions will never cut it. So the better you are. So my business lesson very early in the piece was, Always make sure what you're trying to talk about is understood, not just you raising your flag saying, you know, I've got a doctorate in mathematical neurosciences. It's about explain to me in a way that I can understand. And that was my first, particularly when I start thinking about neuroscientists and people working in very technical, specialized areas. If you can't do that, then you're not going to get very far. Hmm. And by going through this, I've just told you what I do.
Mm-hmm. My doctorate is in psychotherapy, so I know a lot of mumbo-jumbo myself, but I use the same analogy, Stan. I said, basically, it's like being a plumber. You serve an apprenticeship, you keep doing, you get better, you work with people who are better than you, you learn, and eventually, hopefully, you get kind of good at the psychotherapy thing. It really is just that simple.
Look, and as a behaviorist, for me, there are plumbers who just, their expertise is in the pipes, and there are those that are involved in dealing with the people who use the pipes. And that's the use side is what you're talking about. For me, it's, which was where the colouring books came from. There was, in all of the years that I worked as a psychologist, and I did that for 30 more or so of those years, the thing that always, and you would have found this in your own counselling world, therapy world, and in your studies, the hardest part is, after their visit, keeping them motivated to do what you've asked them to do or that they've agreed to do. And we worked in a very busy executive practice. And the doctors on one hand would say, send them to me as the neuro or the psych and let's get them de-stressed, practice some meditation or go through a little bit of therapy or whatever it might be. And but inevitably, the further they got away from you, the less they did. Why would you not be motivated? And then, of course, you see that people would come through a medical practice diagnosed with cancers and not take their pills. Mm. Why would you not take your pills? What would motivate someone to not do something to save their life? And that's the core of, you have to actually be in some form. It's very hard to hear the messages. It's very hard to practice the content, be motivated, unless you're actually coming from a place of peace, place of homeostasis. And the colouring was about that. The colouring was about, in my practice, if I got them to colour, and this was just purely coincidental, I happened to have EEG technology on this young lady who had quite a serious mental illness, and it was just per chance, I've been playing around with the idea of the brain actually does it rest and settle and calm, because you see it with children when they colour. Why wouldn't an adult do that? And she coloured, and I'm watching the EEG and she's calming, and the more calm she got, the more able she was able to listen to the messages. There's science working across your desktop.
Mm-hmm.
That you would suddenly be able to understand that at the heart of our motivation, we've actually got to be able to take in these messages. We've got to be, from my view, in this state of homeostasis, in a state of balance, because unless we're there, our brains won't respond in the way that we want to. Pipes won't turn on.
Mm-hmm.
Want to. The electrical circuit board won't work the way we want it to.
Well, that leads, I think, to the first lesson. The subset is 10 wisdoms you learned in 40 years of science. So number one is, in God we trust, all others must bring data.
Yes, and I actually used that saying just a couple of days ago at a Catholic college. And I said, look, I have to take a stance here. I'm not sure where you're going to come through when I say this. But if we're going to implement some of these ideas, they're only going to be ideas supported by data. The colouring book idea was supported by data. It wasn't just a manufactured idea with an anecdotal outcome. We needed to see that there was an actual influence. And I think I've never left this. It's not that it has to drive us. It just has to support us. We have a brain that requires data. Mm-hmm. It is built for distance evaluation. It is built for evaluating danger. It's built for fear. Whatever else you want to say, our original ancient brain in our deep limbic system on the top of our brain stem, it's not changed in 400,000 years, and of course the millions of years of development to get to us to our current state. And it still relies on data, but often not good data. You know, it makes things, our brain makes things up, unfortunately. So because the real world and the fantasy world of thought are the same thing to our brain. But still, my contention is that we still can have our beliefs, but we really, as a human, we need data. And that's a great wisdom. I'm pulling that off the Americans a little bit there with the...
I should say to... Yeah, I guess people know on American coinage, there is emblazed the phrase, "In God we trust." And yes, the joke being that everybody else has to come with data. But that's what persuaded me, Stan. I mean, the idea of coloring... You cited the science. You pioneered some of the research yourself. It's like, I'll simplify, coloring, believe it or not, for whatever reason, doesn't matter. Coloring relaxes the brain and thus allows for peak performance. Because, and you're an expert in stress, I hope everybody knows this by now, the more relaxed, calm you are, the better able you are to perform. And I can tell you from my own experience, and I use psychometrics, the more stressed you are, the more your attention narrows and your probability of making errors, forced or unforced, rises significantly. So whether business, school, studying, sports, whatever, a state of relaxation, not sleepiness, but relaxed alertness is optimal.
It simply can't. The brain cannot do anything except be not optimal in a stressed situation. Now, pressure is good. Pressure is not stress. Pressure is converted by resilience into either stress or performance. We get up in the morning, we're pressured. That doesn't necessarily stress us. Our amount of resilience, you know, we then bounce in according to our resilience. But, you know, every day is a new day. Every day I'm above ground is a good day. And our messaging starts to go, and that turns into a performance. We get out of bed. But if it turned into a stress, we stay in bed. You know, I feel ill. I can't function. I'm sick of the world. I'm sick of work. It's that process. And this idea of homeostasis in there, this whole system is lubricated, you know, and is able to act optimally. You know, that circuit board that I've been talking about, as much as we can stay in homeostasis or allostasis. Now, allostasis, of course, and allostatic load probably being the thing that, you know, the more I've got up every morning and I have the resilience to do that and I convert it to performance rather than stress and do the wrong things, that process, I mean, when we're much younger, we bounce up, you know, it's another day, but we're a little bit like a tree, you know, that image of a lone tree on a cliff, you know, with the wind blowing it over, you know. Well, when we were young and our homeostasis, we bounce back, homeostasis being bounce back, coming back into that, we bounce back. But you can imagine we humans are like that tree, you know, the wind has blown and blown and blown and blown, and our bounce back is no longer that far. Our bounce back is, well, on a really bad windy day, we're almost touching the ground, but when we bounce back, we bounce back only so far. That's called allostatic load. Mm-hmm. And allostatic load is the part in which most of us are operating. We can get so far back, but even so, you know, we need to have that bounce back, because the brain, once all those information comes into our sensory thalamus, you know, remember everything that comes into your brain goes through into the sensory thalamus. It decides whether it's sight, sound, touch, feel. It then shoots it It's supposed to shoot it straight up there into your frontal cortex, which is sort of the command and control part of the brain. And it's sort of thinking, okay, that's a visual. Okay, I'm going to shoot that to that part of the brain. And on its way, it jumps into a thing called the hippocampus, which is where all our learning occurs. It says, have you seen this before? Have I done this before? Have I, you know, what would I normally do? And then it shoots it back. And then in its final effort, remember, we're talking milliseconds. I'm describing something over a minute, but it's taking milliseconds. And at the end part there, when operating in homeostasis, from homeostasis, it will then pass by the parts of the brain, the deep limbic system, where it's got all the emotional stuff. And then it sort of goes, well, you know, is there something else I should add? And then it turns into an action. But when we're out of balance, when we're not in homeostasis, it just goes straight to the deep limbic. It just goes to the amygdala. It's hijacked. It spins around in there for too long. It gets more and more emotional. And it was our ancient brain. We're built for that, you know, something jumping out of the dark at us. Mm. There's no need, if you're about to be run over the bus, to run it past your frontal lobe and check whether buses are going to hurt you. you're just going to react. And that's that emotional component.
Pointing out, I mean, that system that we're talking about, it's not a flaw in a system. Let's just take a moment to appreciate that system for keeping us and all of our ancestors alive so we can have this conversation.
Yeah, no, absolutely correct. It's just that it goes out of balance. When it gets locked in, that's why, you know, in a certain flash moment, you'll act, in everyday people language, you'll just act in a way that you never would. Why have I just forgotten the name of the managing director? Or why am I a footballer who normally for a living kicks this ball or hits this ball 1,000 times a day? And today in a pressure moment, I hit it or kicked it or whatever, like I'm a 5-year-old. Why would that occur when I'm actually have my brain's motor cortexes actually practice to within a nanosecond of its life to act in exactly the same way? Why would that have occurred?
Hmm. Well, that takes me to lesson number two. The more we learn about the brain, the bigger the mystery it remains.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And the number that we bandy around is often, it's 3 pounds of spaghetti bolognese in white sauce. You know, this brain of ours. It's an analogy I usually use when I'm hungry, for obvious reasons, but that's its size, you know, and yet it is so unbelievably mysterious to us. I would say back in 1979, when I first started this sort of work, which is, goodness, how old am I? We're looking at a world in which we always thought we'd had a grasp of about 10%. And you know what? All these years later, I haven't changed. All I've changed is the 10% I thought I knew, I no longer know. And I've got another 10% that I now think I know, but I'm almost guaranteed not knowing. and this will link back to the last question that you have. My goodness, if I could just live another 40 years, I would be in heaven because we really, for me, between 1980 and 2005, we were in the technology hadn't jumped for us. You know, it was still big machines, hospital data. You know, now it's mobile data. You know, we've even got machines now where I can put the machine on my head and your head, and I can start monitoring whether, in fact, we have, for example, and this is a great debate for another day, but debate free will. If you truly have free will, then why did your brain actually send you a message before? You know, when I said that, you thought that, but before you thought that, something else happened in your brain and I just saw it. So tell me again about free will.
I know this. I read this years ago And I am still trying to wrap my mind around it, which takes us to point number three.
Yeah, you better move us along.
Point number three, the mind-body connection is real. I knew that, but I didn't know how real it is and how fast it works. But that's what you're illustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we see that a lot. If we move into the behavioral sciences, it's like the current work going on with depression and certain body hormones. And my goodness, what's causing what in here? You know, these are really this causation effects in terms of the mind and the body. But the best one has been, of course, the discoveries in the autonomic nervous system. So central nervous system, autonomic nervous system, para and sympathetic systems. Push and pull. Yeah, it controls all of our organs, and it does so subconsciously, even unconsciously. Some things are subconscious. You can affect your breathing, but you can't affect how quickly your kidneys are operating. Or, you know, there are a whole bunch of systems trying to keep you currently at the right temperature. Now, you're not thinking about those. It's busily trying to keep you in homeostasis, because that's the whole point of our existence. And a few colleagues of mine went on into neurosurgery. And you know, into the medical profession, they used to always say to me, "Well, Stan, you know, when one day when you can actually find physical way in which a thought turned into anxiety, if you can finally tell me that, I'll believe the mind-body connection." And of course, when we actually found that the production, you know, when anxiety occurs, and cortisol, and we could see the cortisol occur in there, as a result of the para and sympathetic nervous systems trying to balance themselves. And then we bring in the bioscientists, a little bit more like me in this process, who go, "Well, isn't that interesting? When the cortisol goes in there and stays in there too long, it produces a protein, a beta protein. And a protein, by definition, has substance." And that was why the first few times we found that the buildup of those proteins would happen in the heart and the head. And of course, that's heart attack and aneurysm. And so there was the link. There was the mind-body link. That was like we just landed on Mars, you know, like really type of link in that science of mind and body connection. Because my mind, you know, my brain doesn't differentiate between reality or not reality. I can be anxious because I just think something's going to happen to me. It's not that something will happen to me or is happening to me. It will happen to me. And if I maintain that for too long, as you would know as a behaviorist, all of the consequences of that, you can see the consequences. You know, people break out, they start sweating, they can't remember names, they get headaches, they feel sick, but we could never find that connection in there. But we did find that. There it was. And now we're finding, oh, well, you know, the fluids in the body, though, don't go into the brain. You know, the brain's got its own fluid. You know, you can't actually exchange fluids in there. But in fact, the latest research, this is why I'm saying the 10% rule, it's just that they're finding they are exchanging between those fluids. And this is, again, you know, new research, but it's very, very powerful stuff. So mind-body connection, the whole relay, you know, I wrote a whole book about it. That was what the mindfulness, the neuroscience of mindfulness was about. Why wouldn't mindfulness have these effects? And the core of that was our ability to look at this autonomic nervous system, the way it maintains things. Here's my brief for executives in the process here. Why was it in our practice? Over 20 years, we monitored stress levels in using conventional psychometrics. But then along came people like me who just started doing biometrics and as markers, etc. But just for the sake of it, we found that progressively the stress levels of this executive group, and we would have 1,800 of them a year come through for their executive health evaluation. They didn't come in because they were sick. They came in because their company said, "We want, you know, you're worth a lot of money to us, alive and well." But what we found was they were progressively more, you know, something like 20% would say, you know, 25 years ago they were stressed. And today, well, up until a year or two ago, nearly 40% of them would say that they were, you know, struggling with life. Okay, okay. And then we would go for, so are you drinking? No, not that much anymore. Smoking? No. Are you eating properly? Yes, I know all about that. Are you exercising? Well, you know, clearly senior executives and executive types, they still, you know, sort of carry pounds. But my point is, we think our lifestyles are much better. And even though we've got all of this working in a certain way, we turn around and we go, well, isn't that interesting? Diabetes 2 is raging amongst. Why would diabetes 2, which is an environmental, a lifestyle diabetes, where they are in fact doing all the things, biologically, all the right things to not be, I'm talking borderline, you know, that your doctor would give you the pamphlet saying you are borderline diabetes 2. Nearly all of them. It's that close. Why would that be when they're actually got so much going on that's right about, you know, because they're well-educated, they know what they should be, and they're doing, and their partners are probably bashing them up all the time, keeping them, you know. And the answer, of course, is the one thing that was growing in there, which was stress.
Mm-hmm.
Stress for me is the release and the maintenance of those cortisol hormones in their system. Cortisol and the release of these amyloid proteins, this is the marker in here and is behind so much that's sort of busying itself trying to kill us.
Mm.
Sorry, we're only up to number two.
on that positive. Well, but yeah, but at least to the next
one. They are connected.
Yeah. At least to the next one, which is, and you'll have to translate this one for me, reflex to reaction in 0.25 seconds.
Yes. Remember I was talking about the sensory thalamus, and in comes the information through there and it whips it through the brain. When our brain operates in its information processing, the average adult person, that takes a quarter of a second to process. Anything that's coming in takes a quarter of a second. The best a human brain can do is 0.1 of a second in terms of processing, and a reflex, which is not a reaction, is 0.08 of a second. So that's how quick the brain works. Why is that important? Because if I go back to my data is everything, we now have techniques where we can very quickly assess how quickly your brain processes information. And if it's being hijacked, this was the point of this one, if it's being hijacked, you can suddenly go out to 0.35 or 0.45. It means I've got a way of knowing whether your brain is actually processing efficiently or is being hijacked by your emotional controllers. And it gives me, when I'm talking with students who want to process information quickly and more efficiently so that they can get better results, or athletes, for example, it's the same thing. This ability to have a number of tasks so I can know. If a person came to see you, Duff, and they're anxious and you're helping them through that process, but wouldn't it be lovely for you to be able to, in a couple of minutes, set their personal benchmark, you know where their brain's operating, and actually through your endeavours know that you've freed up that connection in the brain. You know, you're now able to minimize the disruption coming out of the emotional controls.
And I think the point is our nervous systems get hijacked all the bloody time by fear, stress, imaginary fears, circumstances, conditions, things that prey on our mind, and the things that we allow to prey on our mind, allow yes. this hijack to occur. And the hijacking of the central nervous system has definite, measurable, physiological results.
Correct.
Mm. All right. Lesson number five, 20 minutes times 20 meters times 20 seconds. This sounds like my workout routine. Sounds like intervals.
Well, again, from a neuroscience perspective, what we know is that you need to change your brain's focus every 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are now 40 minutes in, and if you actually want to recalibrate your brain, bring it back into not jumping around everywhere trying to work out what I'm about to say and what you're about to say to me and what have you. All of the people listening, the optimum would be every 20 minutes, you look up from what you're doing. You find a spot 20 meters away and you focus on that for 20 seconds. That's what that meant. You have recalibrated your brain.
Let me make sure I understand this. This sounds pretty idiot-proof. Every 20 minutes, I look at something 20 meters away, focus on it or allow it to gaze at it for 20 seconds, and that recalibrates my brain.
Yep, it resets it.
Excellent.
And we know that it does that because we've watched it in do so in the monitors, but just anecdotally, it sort of makes sense. And we actually prove this with gamers. So gamers are the one, you know, if we go back to the 0.25, gamers, those are the professional kids that play the video games in competitions that these days make millions of dollars with millions of people watching them play for 20-minute sessions.
And they're televised too. They're on television shows on ESPN. I've seen them.
Yeah, but they were the source of the study for me because, again, if they are operating at 0.25, a la the previous one, they are already retired. They operate between 0.1 and 0.15. You know, they're so fast. And that's why they're about 17 years of age, because that processing is unencumbered. You know, they just...
Dan, is that a reflex or a reaction you're describing?
No. A reflex operates below 0.1. Mm-hmm. It operates at 0.08.
Okay.
And that's the reason for that is it doesn't go through the brain. It just operates through the nervous system. When we have a reaction, it goes through the brain. And it can't go through the brain any quicker than 0.1 of a second. But that's what that's where the 20-20-20 came from in the process.
Does processing slow with age?
Yes.
Yeah, I was afraid of that. I was. Let me ask you again. Does processing slow with age?
But we can also improve with that. You and I will never operate at the level of the gamers. We have too many other pathways in our brain for information to process itself along. You know, it's going to go everywhere. And we will never have that because of our experience. Because remember, this is not reflex. This is reaction. Mm-hmm. And a reaction must pass across the emotional controllers of the brain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the older we get, the more of those reactions and pathways and, you know, and then into the hippocampus. Oh, what happened when that happened? And, you know, it's all going on in a nanosecond, remember?
Yeah.
But boy, there's a lot going on in that process.
Well, let's keep talking about rewiring the brain. Point number six, rewiring the brain by CBS equals BUS.
Well, that wasn't quite right. Now, this goes back to this is not a new invention, but it's about pathways. Let me put it to you. The current view of the situation is not equal to the best view of the situation. And the best view of the situation is at least 10 times better than your current view of the situation. Now, current view of the situation is not equal to the best view of the situation. Let's just start with that. Let's just start with that one. This is not new, but in the context of this neuroscience and where it's going, it's just brilliant. Because if I say to you black, you say
white.
Yeah. If I say a company resembles a tortoise in its performance, you think
hair.
Well, that's it. But what if you think it in terms of a company that isn't performing well, and I call it tortoise-like? What would you think the company's?
Slow moving, slow to adapt, slow to change.
Correct. Now you just said that because the current view of your situation, which is that situation, is equal to the best view, which was that it's slow. You know, that's the equals. But what if I said it doesn't equal that? What if I said to you, you know, if you thought about that different, you might have said stable, dependable, giving, you know, always going to, you know, add to your superannuation fund. But that wasn't your automatic view because the brain operates that way. As soon as it's got a view, you will say what it believes is the best view because that's what engaged it. But what if we can actually train our brain to say that the current view is not equal to the best view? We find a different pathway. And if I support that with that view, that better view will always be 10 times better than the current view, then maybe I'll bang my brain into new pathway. And if I then say to you, the other part of this formula is times 100. If I said to you that if you said that 100 times a day, the current view of the situation is not equal to the best view of the situation, then I would say to you, your brain will actually consider the next time I say to you, a company that resembles a tortoise performs in what way, you will go somewhere different.
Let me make sure I understand this. So the point is the current view of the situation is not equal to the best view of the situation. The best view of the situation is at least 10 times better than the current view of the situation. And the more I focus, deal, or ingest, or imbibe the best view of the situation, the greater range of desired outcomes can occur.
Yeah, because there are other views. You know, our brain is shortcutting. It's going, you know,
heuristics is the word for that.
Correct. But here's a way. Now, let me give you an example about why 100 times a day. I'm sure you've learnt your times table somewhere along in this process. So 7 times 3 equals?
21, last time I checked.
8 times 8?
64.
Yeah. Why do you know that?
Drilled into me as a kid.
Correct. You know, our brain is actually still, no matter how many education professors I have this debate with, our brain is still structured to learn by rote. Mm-hmm. If you continue to learn your tables, you know, there's an argument now, well, you don't need to know those. You've got, you know, as long as you've got the two numbers and you know what you're trying to do. But the fact of the matter is, you know, built into your subsets, into this world where I started of data, we need to understand distances. We need to understand differences. We need numbers for all of that. And that's why you learnt those tables. And you learnt them because you did it by rote. I'm telling you, the current view of the situation not equal to the best view of the situation. You say that 100 times until the next time you and I meet and I say to you, so Duff, you know, what's the thinking algorithm? And you go to me, current view of the situation not equal to the best view of the situation. I know that your brain will actually think that way. Isn't that fascinating? That you'll create different pathways. And again, that's a, you know, there's been a quite a few people who've sort of worked in this space before we had the brain science. And I just think that's a great way to teach our brain to do things differently.
Well, and a way to practice it, at least in my experience, is using different words than you usually prefer. I tell people life is a smorgasbord, a behavioral smorgasbord. And people, you, I, everyone, we have patterns, we have preferences. We tend to do the same behaviors over and over again. But there is a smorgasbord available. So why not sample one or two and you will get a different reaction? That reminds me of, remember Seinfeld? Did you watch Seinfeld?
Yes,
remember
yes.
The uber loser George Costanza? There was an episode where he reversed 180 degrees everything that he normally did and said, and he had unmitigated success in his life. You know, the women liked him, he got hired, and he was desired. And then I was talking about Seinfeld to a friend of mine who is a very senior psychiatrist in Australia. And he said, yeah, my brother, who is a psychiatrist also, does that with his patients. I said, what do you mean? He gets them to try the exact opposite of behaviors that they have been doing. And I experimented with this, and I got to tell you, it was a eureka moment for me. All of a sudden, the world responded differently because I was initiating using different words, using different behaviors. I was acting differently.
Yeah, new pathways, which is also one of my points.
Well, let's see if we're getting there. Point number seven.
By the way, before we move on, what is my thinking algorithm?
CVS does not equal BVS.
Yeah. And what does that say? What does that mean? What
current view of the situation is not equal to the best view of the situation, Stan, and the best view of the situation is at least 10 times better than the current view of the situation. And if you say that to yourself, Stan, 100 times a day, you'll be surprised at the results.
Yeah. Well, and how long will that take? That literally will take 1 minute and 40 seconds of your day.
I'm too busy. I don't have time for that.
Well, just practice it on your walk from the kitchen to your car. I don't know what it is. But remember, at the moment, you've only got it in working memory. We've got to get it in deep into your memory, into your long-term memory where your times tables are. Because that's where your brain will dig in when it's processing, you know, that situation that you're in. That's where it will go. And if it finds that, it will act on that.
Lesson number 7. This sounds like geometry to me. Infinity, circle, square, and triangle exercises for the brain.
Yeah. So now I'm into practical neuroplasticity. Remember that 3 pounds of spaghetti bolognese? Well, let's turn that into 3 pounds of Play-Doh. Is Play-Doh something everyone knows? Sort of molding.
I don't know if they still have it, but I certainly played with it when I was a kid.
Yeah, well, remember Play-Doh? So think of the brain as Play-Doh. So when we say now, which is the whole world of neuroscience now regards the brain as plastic, Play-Doh. So when you change one thing, something else changes. The thing can't get bigger. It doesn't, well, it does shrink. You know, as we get older, I hate to tell you, Duff.
I know.
But it doesn't actually add any mass. So, for example, whenever we look at people with specific skills, there's areas of the brain which are bigger, but they're to the deficit of other parts of the brain which are smaller. So people who have great insight into mathematics, the Newtons, all of these people who have masses there were unable to communicate. That was because of brain plasticity. What we now know is that we can actually work with brain plasticity. We can actually help our brain become more active in certain areas. But how? Okay, you can sit there right now and start thinking up for yourself how you would like to be more mathematical. You know, really? Okay, come on. What are you going to do in that process? And this whole idea of plasticity, I condense down to, let's just take the infinity symbol for a moment. And what I've done there is I've laid it down for everyone who's listening or watching. It's just on its side there, you know, and you can't, if you're listening, you can't see it, but I'm with my right hand because I tend to use my right hand. I'm just got my finger going in an infinity symbol now. I know that if I look at the technology as I'm sort of airing, you know, I'm doing an air infinity symbol. As I'm doing that, I know my right hand is actually being driven by my left brain, and my left brain is communicating the movements to my motor cortex across the brain, across the corpus callosum, big U-shaped piece in the brain, which is its central processor. And it's sending it through the central processor. It's pretty easy. It's used to me using my right hand. It sort of gets it, you know, the motor cortex is going and I'm doing my infinity symbol. And you can do this with a pen on paper, which is even better as part of the process. But then what if I change hands? So I go change hands. So I do this symbol with my other hand and I'm doing this relatively well because I'm used to doing this and showing this and practicing it. And if I put it in a pen and I put it on paper, yeah, look, it's a little wobbly, but I can do it. But I'm now using my right hemisphere. But what I'm saying to you, Duff, is if you now do this with both hands, you know, you have a try now. Well, you know, Duff,
I don't know if I'm that athletic, you know, but I'll
you don't
try.
Get to sit. You don't get to this. Okay, now that's beautiful. So, for those of you who aren't watching this, Duff has done what every human does first. He's actually mirroring the image. His right brain. Are you right-handed, Duff?
Yes, it's my dominant.
You tend to use your right hand the most. Yeah. So your brain just said to your, you know, to the other side, it said, just mirror, you know, well, there we go. So it's how you go out and around and, you know, you're really using one side of the brain. But if I say to you now, Duff, start at the top of one and start at the bottom of the other.
Okay.
And now go.
Now I gotta think here, Stan. Thinking slows me down significantly, you know. I prefer
now,
this one.
You can see this much better with pens. So mm-hmm. If your listeners do this on paper, you know, your right will go all right and the left will go everywhere. And then all of a sudden it'll start to go that way. And eventually you can even cross so that your left hand, if you're right-handed, gets much better than the other hand. What you're doing is, your brain is now communicating across the corpus callosum. It's actually improving the pathways. It's making more part. It's the use it or lose it philosophy that's going on in neuroscience at the moment. By now activating the two hemispheres and coordinating them together through the corpus callosum, you're dealing with things like dyslexia, dysphasia, aphasia, all of the communication problems that so many children and adults who undiagnosed or just covered it up have dealt with, because that central processor, the corpus callosum, has for whatever reason become tangled. And these sorts of exercises, and I put there's the infinity symbol, but you could also do circles at the same time with both hands in different. You can do squares and triangles. Try doing a circle and a square at the same time. With one hand, do a circle, and with the other hand, do a square.
Maybe off camera, I'll try that. Maybe.
Yeah, no, I did, again, you know, I'm covering a lot of neuroscience here.
Well, just so people know, correct me if I'm wrong, the corpus callosum is a thick band of nerves between the left and the right hemispheres of the brain, and it transmits information between the two hemispheres.
Correct. It's like a central processor in the brain. Yeah. That's where the tangles occur that lead to all of those phasic disorders, and is probably the primary playground for most cognitive neuroscientists, where they're trying to unravel all of that. And I do so with executives as well. Now, you know, this is a way to unblock, you know, create new pathways. You're actually doing neuroplasticity when you do that exercise. Yeah, you're creating new pathways.
All right. Well, let me go on to lesson number 8. I'll sleep when I'm dead.
Well, I think that in the last 10 years, I've come to the opinion that sleep and the understanding of sleep and being able to improve sleep is one of the greatest neurological finds of forever. You know, we all know it. But I can remember I was working with one of the big airlines, and I was with a group of executives, and we were discussing, you know, they're making big changes, and they were interested in the application of some of these tools that I developed and what have you. And they were talking about the stress of the time. And I said, well, don't you need some sleep? And one of them piped up and said to me, well, you know what? I'll sleep when I'm dead. And I said, really? Well, then let me tell you something that I know. And that is that you're going to be dead a lot sooner than you expect. But I've got to tell you, in this story, a month later, one of them in that meeting dropped dead.
There's a lot of macho-ness in senior executives about sleep. And Matthew Walker is probably the reigning expert on this. If you have a chance to listen to him on a podcast or read his book, I mean, you want data? He'll give you some data.
Yeah, and absolutely.
When people say to me, I'll sleep when I'm dead, and say, yeah, and you'll be sleeping sooner than you think too, pal. Because I thought I knew a bit about sleep because I read Dement's book years ago. But no, Matthew Walker put the data, and the drop-off in productivity and longevity is precipitous, not a slow, steady decline. Yes. It's like jumping off a cliff.
Yes, yeah. No, and part of that is understanding sleep is not about an answer for fatigue. Sleep is part of a 24-hour cycle in which the brain just switches functions for a certain amount of time, which are necessary for its continuing optimal performance. Study after study now shows that it's not driven by fatigue. That's not the reason. You know, how many people don't sleep even though they feel tired? It's just that it's part of a 24-hour cycle, which in fact is important. My favorite analogy for the brain these days is that it's a battery. You know, it's a circuit board with a big battery, and its whole processing, you know, the reasons that, you know, some of the other things that I've been discussing here, you know, it's shortcuts, it's habitual behaviors. You know, the brain is not judgmental. You know, when the taps are flowing, when the air conditioning unit is set for high, it's just operating to get you to high, you know, or keep you in normal or whatever it is. There's no judgment process. So why would it not do anything other than what is optimal for it? And that is exactly right. So when we fall asleep and drive off the road into a tree, the reason for that is that it's run out of juice. You know, it's at the point where I cannot maintain you and keep you alive unless I shut you down for the next few minutes. Now, all day long, it operates on the basis of, if I have to stop and think about this, I'm going to use too much energy. That's why we have shortcuts. Why would the brain arrange itself with all these shortcuts unless it had some biological reason to do so? And its biological reason, of course, is that it wants to conserve our energy. And energy is the key component in this whole process. It's actually managing its energy flows, not over a sleep cycle or a day cycle, but over a whole 24-hour cycle. And my next book, which is The Neuroscience of Excellent Sleep.
Excellent. Looking forward to that. Well, that takes us to point number nine, Stan. Time for a Nappuccino. And can I get that at Starbucks?
Well, again, I'll go back to, have you heard of this before?
No. I don't know where you're going with this.
Yeah. So this is about coffee and sleep. Let me explain. When you have a cup of coffee, a chino, you're not immediately stimulated. It takes 20 minutes for it to hit you, in a physiological sense, in that you get the bang.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And coffee works like that. It doesn't graduate itself into your system. It bangs into your system. If I've got you on an EEG, at 20-minute mark, I'll watch your heart. Up she goes. Now let's combine that with nap theory. Now, by that, I mean napping and sleeping theory. Imagine what would happen if you drank a cup of coffee and you then set your phone alarm for 20 minutes and you closed your eyes and napped, so that when the alarm woke you up in 20 minutes, the coffee also hits you.
Mm-hmm.
You are wired.
Wired.
You are wired. You are in supersonic speed for the next 10 to 15 minutes. And that's what's called a Nappuccino. And of course, that was abused by the gamers, and they're because they would just start trying to work out ways to get that even better. And I've actually moved into the world of a decaf Nappuccino. I've actually, you'll find this in the book, up some exercises to replace the coffee, so that when you come out of your nap, you can actually wake your brain really quickly and effectively. So that was the idea of, that was one of the things, current things that are about to hit. So there's a number of little exercises we can use from our nap, because napping is brilliant if you need to nap. Napping is not brilliant if you don't need to nap. that's the key here. Yeah? Mm. Don't people forcing themselves to nap is like their five-year-olds on the nap mat in their kindergartens. Some go off. And others just find it impossible. And that's the same with us adult humans.
Stan, when is your book on sleep being published?
Well, it's with the publishers at the moment. So they're they haven't given me the date for its release. But okay.
Please be sure to let us know so we can promote it accordingly.
Sure.
Lesson number 10. On Mars, a day is 24.6 hours long. But how would our brain cope with it?
Yeah, so 24.6 hours. 23 minutes, I think, longer than our day. And believe it or not, we don't know how the brain will cope with that, because this is back into this whole, the brain is a 24-hour cycle. We have a brain that operates on a 24-hour cycle, because there's 24 hours in our day. There's no, you can have more energy, but you can't have more hours.
Mm-hmm.
And and I just wanted to leave it with the concept of how will we deal with being in an environment which has a new definition on that. Will it take us millions of years to adapt to that? And how can we define some science to help us adapt to that? Because what's happening is that's accumulating. It's out of sync with us. That small amount of time is really a challenge. So I'm leaving my last wisdom or insight as the challenge here related to our whole physiological system. How will we, if we're living there, deal with that?
Well, we won't find out, but somebody else will.
Indeed. Yeah, no, I don't think the rover robots care.
Let me ask you one last question. We've been talking a lot about things that you've learned over your 40 years in science and 50 years in life. What have you unlearned lately? And by that, I mean something you absolutely positively knew to be true then, but now, no, is not the case.
It's come and it's gone for me a few times here. And for me, it's two-brain theory. And I just find this so amazing. you know, years ago, I don't know if you saw it all or you were part of it as part of your learning and your executive work, a lot of people went absolutely ballistic about two-brain theory. You know, the left brain does this. And the
right brain.
Remember that? And it went into the schools, you know. Oh, you know, if you're thinking with your left brain, you're being logical, and your right brain, you're being creative and all the rest of it. And the reason for that in those days was that the limited amount of ability to see in there and understand it, it made some sense because in the early scans, you know, MRIs, not before the PET scans and all the other amazing stuff that's around now, but we could see that most of the activity happened on that side. And over the years, that sort of just evolved out. You know, we just sort of, there have been other things. In recent times, and this is where the big discoveries are, while we know certain functions do tend to have a region that you could define as being on the left side or the right side, but the new scanners now show us that not only does that region start to glow under whatever particular instrument, but about 20 other regions in the brain also light up. Maybe not as big, maybe not as dense or whatever it might be, but 20 other regions all over the brain light up. And this, where the neuroscience is now is, why do they light up? What on earth is going on in this brain where that, even though, you know, that's the core area here that I'm pointing at on my left side here, and I know where that fits into all the other bits, but why is it lit up, you know, over on the right side, down the back, just behind this or that? Why is that? And that's where all of the science is right now. You know, because we know brain waves are the superhighway. So when we get an alpha wave, which is our pre-sleep wave, our relaxations wave, we know that that's occurring on one particular side of the brain, but it's also occurring in all these other spots around the brain. That we've found all of those spots are connected by these superhighways for the neurons that are... We couldn't work out for years. How on earth could they all... The reason we didn't think that was going on is because how could they communicate with each other? And, of course, what we've discovered is that the brain waves, which are all different, you know, you get different brain waves in different parts, they've become the superhighways. So they become the connectors. All the parts of the brain that want to talk to each other jump onto the alpha wave, you know, and the alpha wave then connects them all up. And that, to me, was the final demise of two-brain theory, and hence the unlearning. You know, say goodbye. I'd held it there for, you know, even though it had sort of spectacularly burnt in my mind a long time ago. But it was, it sort of always, you know, it was part. But now it is well and truly in the graveyard.
Well, now we know better thanks to guys like you, and we will finish here on that note. Listeners, you've been listening to the International Podcast in Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn. This episode is produced by Robert Hosrey and is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, PDF. They provide webinars, social media discussions, podcast parties, anything you want, everything you need. Professional Development Forum. You can find them online, professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Listener, you've heard from us. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us. We'd like to hear, what sort of wisdom would you like to learn about? Who would you like us to talk to? Please contact us. The email address is podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. In fact, that's our website, 10lessonslearned.com. Until the next episode, thank you for listening. And remember, you've been listening to the only podcast on the internet that's making the world wiser, lesson by lesson. Thanks for joining us.